broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
And indeed, there will be time for the yellow smoke that slides along the street, rubbing its back upon the window panes. There will be time, there will be time to prepare a face, to meet the faces that you meet. There will be time to murder and create, and time for all the works and days of hands to lift and drop a question on your plate. Time for you and time for me, and time yet for 100 indecisions, and time for 100 visions and revisions before the taking of a toast and tea. In the room, the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. And indeed, there will be time to wonder, do I dare? And do I dare? Time to turn back and descend the stair with a bald spot in the middle of my hair. They will say how his hair is growing thin. My morning coat, my collar mounting firmly to the chin, my necktie rich and modest, but asserted by a simple pin. They will say but how his arms and legs are thin. Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute, there is time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse. For I have known them all, already known them all. I have known the evenings, mornings, afternoons. I have measured out my life with coffee spoons. I know the voices dying with a dying fall beneath the music from a farther room. So how should I presume? T.S. Eliot, from The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. On the September edition of Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition, we discussed trigger warnings with Dr. Adam Wood, chair and associate professor in the Department of English and chair of the Academic Freedom and Tenure Committee at Salisbury University, and Dr. James King, associate professor of English and African American Culture Studies. Our discussion focused on trigger warnings and their meaning and use in the university setting. Dr. Wood is with me again today, and we're joined by Dr. Yuki Okubo, assistant professor of psychology at the university, and Don Rush, Delmarva Public Radio news director. We continue our discussion of trigger warnings today, and particularly as this concept of trigger warnings applies in the greater society. Adam, Yuki, Don, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Good to be here.
Thank you for having us.
To offer a brief review, trigger warnings are cautions that alert people to potentially disturbing material that may bring on symptoms or flashbacks to disturbing events in the past and may even trigger episodes of post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. The term trigger warnings has expanded now to basically include any material that might be deemed offensive and might bring discomfort to an individual. You're familiar with some of them. For example, TV announcements warning that a program contains strong language or scenes that some viewers might find offensive. In the university setting, we discuss the point that there is no unanimity of opinion on the use of trigger warnings. And I'd like to ask Dr. Wood, Adam, please, to explain the controversy surrounding the culture that has grown up around trigger warnings as used in its broader context. Adam?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. I think in some ways it's a fairly recent history in terms of what we're seeing now, right? I think that there have always been on university campuses attempts to work with students who have suffered something traumatic, right? If there's a particular difficulty that they had, very often students would approach a professor sort of one-on-one. The shift that we've seen in the past 5, maybe 7 years seems much more sort of widely targeted in that this type of material, be it historical material or literary material or whatever it is problematic, and so we don't think that that should be taught, or at least that students should be warned that they might be reading something sort of problematic. And in and of itself, again, this may not be an issue, but the problem really seemed to emerge, I think, when the list of problematic things kept growing and growing and growing, right? And so we can, you know, certainly understand certain really graphic depictions, either of sexual assault or physical assault or war or something like that. But we began to see more and more students who objected to even the use of certain words or certain narrative perspectives. You know, very often we can think of a novel in which it may be a beautifully written novel, but the narrator is quite a jerk or something like that. And students began to object to any number of those kind of things. And so we saw this movement from students or groups of students, at least, beginning to argue that they need to be warned at every single turn, right? That instead of having perhaps the realization that the university courses in universities might deal with difficult subject matter, the notion was, well, for every single thing we read, we need to get a heads up about what this is just in case it is troubling to us in some ways. And the unfortunate side effect is that there are institutions that have sort of given into this, which often allows students to not have to read certain material, not have to do certain assignments if they feel that it is bothersome in some ways. And so it's unfortunately been an attempt, I think, from certain segments of the student population. And again, this is both on the left and the right, to control the curriculum in some ways, I think. And again, some universities have resisted strongly. I know we talked about the University of Chicago's stance last time, very strongly against the notion of trigger warnings, where other universities have even pushed to require faculty to include trigger warnings on syllabi. And so it's, you know, it's a very interesting time of discussion about these sort of things. And again, just to go back and stress, a lot of people want to blame this on the left, right? Sort of an overly PC culture. And there is that segment of it. But we also see this from certain religious groups, conservative religious groups who say, well, I don't want to be exposed to something that might be hostile to my religious beliefs, so I should be able to get out of that sort of assignment as well. So it's really coming from both sides of the political spectrum in terms of students. And I think a lot of it is that these students have come up in a world where they have been perhaps overly coddled. I mean, they talk about this generation as being the generation of kids who get an award for showing up. And so I think, unfortunately, a lot of times students have been overly protected from the realities of the world. And when they're confronted with it in the university, they don't know what to do. I think of the Eliot poem that you read, right? The inability to do anything, of being so terrified of everything that he can't even get out of the apartment by the end of the poem. And, you know, it's not surprising that Eliot is writing sort of just after World War I, sort of responding to what he saw as a cultural crisis. And I think that we've certainly got a number of elements of cultural crisis going on around us right now.
Well, Adam, two questions that as part of a beginning and a background here. How pervasive across the university setting do you see this this culture of, for lack of a better term, of protection and or avoidance? And then what is the role of media in this growth as well. Social media.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is prevalent enough that it is a legitimate issue. It's certainly a thing that we need to be considering. But I do think that the media, and again on both sides, sort of enjoy playing this up. It's very easy to pick on students, right? To pick on young people, and so when students sort of get upset about these things, I think often that there is a media response of, oh, you know, look at these spoiled kids and their complaints. The problem with that is that it delegitimizes where there are valid complaints, and there are. I think there are certainly, you know, as I said, there are students or there are individuals who have legitimately been traumatized by something, and you know, being aware and empathetic to that is a valuable thing. But for so many of these students, the trauma is much smaller than they want to make it out to be, I think, and sometimes.
And social media?
I think so. You know, I mean, I think this is the era where everyone puts everything out right when they experience it. And so, you know, you can have someone who's younger who's, you know, doing Twitter or something that, oh, you know, McDonald's got my fries cold. You know, I've been traumatized by this. You know, and so I think that even the use of the word trauma has unfortunately been watered down from the serious thing that it actually is for some people.
Yuki, your experience?
Yeah. I think, you know, when we think about trigger warnings, it originated from people who have suffered from PTSD, and that's a clinical terminology that is often sometimes used in lay term where, you know, someone might say traumatized or that I may have PTSD when they may not actually be classified or diagnosed in the clinical term as PTSD. There are certain criteria in which they would have to, you know, fulfill in terms of the symptomatologies, right? But I think we do have this culture in terms of we do use clinical diagnosis in some ways to talk about our day-to-day experience in somewhat of a more tragic, exaggerated way. That's not to say that, yes, some people do suffer from PTSD for a number of different issues, but to sort of use it as a way that kind of exaggerate sort of what they're experiencing, right? And so sometimes the students may overreact or they may feel compelled to say, well, I was offended or I was traumatized. That experience was out of the ordinary in some ways. And in some senses, you know, sometimes students, especially if they can get a group of people that would agree with them, that they might try to sort of voice that opinion.
Right. Let me just ask something right here. There are two things, because I sort of tend to step back a bit. Mm-hmm. And what it seems to me is that particularly students who object to certain words, first and foremost, that all participants don't have the same level of privilege. We recognize that in terms of race.
Right.
So we have some great discussion, for instance, about the use of the N-word. Mm. Certainly, we can reach back to some of the novels of the late 19th century, right, for example, right? The second thing, though, is in discussion about political correctness and trigger words is that what we're really seeing is the growth of a society. And it's sort of banging around, trying to find itself. You have a whole slew of, for instance, new groups that have now come to the fore that are able to express themselves, whether they're ethnic groups, whether they're racial groups, sexual orientation, for example, so that suddenly what you're really seeing is not so much, and I think I take a certain trivialization of it, it's not so much that these things are trivial. It is that this is a growth pattern that's taking place. If you look at it, you know, obviously, society at large, we see the same thing going on, where people are having to deal with terms that perhaps 20 or 30 years ago they could have used in the workplace, but they can't use them anymore, right? And so, as a matter of fact, the most dramatic probably sense of that was a series called Mad Men, in which, right, it was the 1950s and 60s, and we saw how women were treated and how they referred to. Well, you wouldn't do that today. So when I look at the students, and sometimes we say, oh, gee, you know, the claim is, gee, it just seems sort of odd to us, or we want to trivialize it or whatever. I think it's just part of the growing pains of society. And this younger generation, not so much that they're coddled, is that they're trying to find their way into the future. And I think that's, I think, the difference. So, yes, as they might object, and you may say, gee, this is not as traumatic or this shouldn't be traumatic to you because you didn't experience X, Y, and Z. But at the same time, they're pushing the boundaries and trying to figure out where they are. And in 50 years, the society will probably be better for this kind of push and shove that they're continually doing.
Well, I would agree with that. I mean, I think it goes towards the Eliot poem that you read, right? Again, we think of Eliot writing at this time of tremendous historical sort of upheaval, right? And we see in Eliot's poetry, not only in the love song, but in The Wasteland itself, right? The idea that the world seems to be coming apart at the seams, right? Eliot is being confronted by a world that seems radically different. And in some ways it was, right? We think about the growth of immigrant populations, the new rights that blacks in America had. And so Eliot is sort of confronting this. And very often in those moments of cultural crisis, there are sort of two reactions, right? One is a sort of embracing of plurality, right? Which can add to that overwhelming sense, right? You know, we think about the numbers of terms for groups of people as was sort of being in and out. The flip side is to sort of retreat into some mythological past as it was, you know, which is what Eliot did, right? That we had a number of these modernist writers who sort of retreated into, the idea of a past that never really was. Oh, when things were more stable, right? And we see this at any number of moments. I mean, it's interesting to mention the 1950s. You know, we think of, Dan Quayle years and years ago who talked about, well, we need to return to the, you know, traditional family values in the 1950s. But the 1950s that he was referring to wasn't real. You know, he's referring to Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best, the sort of constructs of it. And so, I do think that both reactions are indicative of a certain kind of growing pain, I think, culturally, that America is having to work through. And I think we see this playing out, not to sort of rush into this, but in even the current presidential sort of forum, where there is a strange battle between a regression and a progression. Now, we can look at that in any number of ways, but I think that anxiety is very much real in America right now.
Well, what I thought as I looked at the issue of trigger warnings and our discussion earlier on the college campuses and the kind of culture that is growing in. And Don, I think, offered a very, very good rationale for part of that culture that's growing and this trying to find your way in a new world, a new world of conflict, a new world of communication, instant communication, instant information, and my question in looking at the broader society, which you hit on a little bit, Adam, is how did our university students, how did this culture emerge on the university campuses? And what it made me think of is what is happening in our own culture that because that's where these students came from. They come out of this broader setting that we're familiar with. So what was going on? What is going on in this culture that has created this kind of, I don't want to use a pejorative word, but it's almost a defensiveness among the students. You can't do this to me. And the whole safe spaces idea, if I don't like it, I can go somewhere and get away from it. So my question for you is really, and you hit on it a little bit, is what is going on in our culture that feeds this young people's culture on university campus? You mentioned, Adam, the 1950s, and I grew up in the 1950s. And in my university years, we kind of talked about this as the age of anxiety. And, you know, for the first time after the Second World War, we realized that we could destroy civilization. And that had a significant psychological, I think, impact. And we looked at it as problems with individuals. We didn't, I don't think we saw the age of anxiety, the 50s, as kind of a cultural thing. We saw it as kind of an individual thing where then we got a whole body of literature on the age of anxiety. The psychologists, Viktor Frankl, Rollo May, Eric Fromm, and then the whole culture of the novel emerging at that time, with particularly the French existentialists and then the German existentialists and on. But they were dealing with it as an individual kind of thing, it seemed to me, in which they were saying, you've got to learn to deal with this. You've got. I don't know. And you can if you don't agree, that's fine. But I kind of picked up our time as kind of an age of secular of cultural insecurity, not so much a total individual thing, but the whole culture seems to have this insecure feeling. Does that make sense to any of you?
Well, I think that there are a couple of things happening. And if you, for instance, if you're talking about the 1950s, and in some ways I look at the 1950s as really kind of a closeted period in which you had a lot of anxieties, lots of stuff that was bubbling underneath. If there was a civil rights movement, for example, there was anxiety for women. The problem that had no name that Betty Friedan, for instance, talks about. And all of that then explodes into the 1960s, where all this stuff is then sort of undone, right? So the women, suddenly you have the feminist movement and women's movement. You've got the Hispanics begin to pick up steam. Obviously, the civil rights movement, African Americans. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, all these groups, which had been sort of suppressed underneath the major culture, and you could sort of see that in the television programs, they were all like pushed down, and then all these suddenly they just like sprung up, right? So, and we've lived with that revolution. I think what we're looking now at is a situation where the white portion of the population is shrinking. So by 2050, the whites are going to be a minority, okay? And you are already seeing sort of, I think, on a political standpoint, I think you're seeing a pushback from that may say, take back America. There's a sense that particularly a lot of smaller white communities, they see the culture shifting away, and I think that's been emphasized with, say, the election of Barack Obama, the first African American president. Now looks as if we're going to have, say, for instance, the first woman president, and you can even see in the political dialogue that the gender stuff that's been there, it's been bubbling forth, it's coming forth again, but in a much different way, just as we saw, for instance, the racial pushback with Obama. So I think we're living through a period in which we're now going to see the culture change further and further, so that, for instance, there will be a lot of folks who hearken back to the idea of, well, you know, I want my country back. I want the way it was. But it's not there because it gets irritated and by the fact that you've got these now prominent individuals who are ascending to the White House itself.
No, I think you're right. And again, I think going back to the Dan Quayle joke that I made earlier, the idea of the 50s, you know, because, I mean, it's strange that we have certain individuals now tend to be on the right, sort of hearkening back to the glory days of the Reagan 80s. And in the Reagan 80s, they were trying to hearken back to the glory days of the 1950s. And you think about those cultural images of the 1950s, is, I think, a lot of what you're saying on it. It's a phenomenally white upper middle class existence, right? I mean, if you watched Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best, you would think that there were only white upper class middle people in America, right? And I mean, there were no minorities of any kind, right? There were women who were at work. You know, mom's job was to wear pearls and make cookies, and it was never like that. You know, particularly when we think about how women were out working during World War II, and all of a sudden had to be told, "Oh, go back home. That freedom that you had is now gone." And so, you know, even those shows in the 50s that we tend to have as reference points are an America that never was. I mean, it never was that way. There, as you said, there were underneath the surface, there were a number of those tensions, and even above the surface, but we didn't see them. I think the flip side today is that, and again, this goes back to the media, we see everything immediately, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's almost, I think that there's perhaps a sensory overload in some ways, right? Where we think about that segment of white America that Don mentioned is sort of, oh my God, now I have to deal with this other group too. I was confused by the first 10 and now there's five more. And so again, you know, to sort of stick one's head in the sand is this, you know, bizarre attempt to pretend those things don't exist, right? Even the notion of, well, let's get rid of all the immigrants who are in this country. I mean, other than being wrongheaded, doesn't actually address that anxiety. It's just, oh, well, let's not look at it in some way.
I think, you know, and sort of bringing it back to the current, you know, typical college age, you know, students, mm-hmm. right? I think they have grown up in a time in which, again, you know, in terms of generational changes, we always talk about each generation actually has been, you know, whenever as they were growing up and becoming young adults, I think we have been told, oh, you're this way, you're that way, whether it's Generation X or whatever it may be. But what the college age students are dealing with right now, I think, or they grew up in an era in which they had smartphones and all these gadgets that has essentially plugged them into the world 24/7. And I think what they may not have experienced in growing up is sort of knowing that you can actually, you know, pull the plug every once in a while to have the break. And so then, you know, as Adam was saying, like there is a sensory overload of a lot of things because if they don't, you know, do something proactively, they're consistently getting the messages, whether they like it or not. And so there is already like an overload of things that they're being exposed to. And then, you know, they're thinking, okay, is this a factual information? A lot of times what they're listening to are assumptions or predictions of things. I think the news these days are very different from when, for example, when I was growing up, where it tended to be more factual. Like we talk about what we know at this point in time. We're not going to speculate what could potentially be happening. But there's a lot of assumptions and speculations that are being made, especially in social media. And so then they're not just exposed to what could be happening, but they're, you know, exposed to potentials of all these things that fuels the culture of fear, I think, that we can be fearful of a number of things, whether they're actually close in physical proximity or not. They are psychologically, emotionally close to things that they may not necessarily be experiencing.
Well, I guess you've kind of hit on on the next step that that I wanted to explore. Don talked about the civil rights movement, the feminist revolution, and Yuki, you would know this better than I, but that was my era, and it seemed to me that activity, we kind of plunged ourselves into the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the anti-war movement on into the 60s at the time, and who had time to be anxious anymore? We were busy, and we were busy. We had something we could grab onto that we could shape the civil rights movement. I mean, you could put yourself in there. You saw potential into it. You saw the capacity if you invested yourself. So You didn't have time to think about the Cold War, particularly if you got involved in those things. So I guess in my reading, everybody kind of pegged 9/11 as when so many things changed in this country. And I call it we became insecure or we became anxious again. I think it was more of a cultural insecurity. So with 9/11, we kind of experienced for the first time that a lot of things were not in our control as a culture. And it wasn't something you could understand, even. So I don't know where are we now in terms of either anxiety or call it cultural insecurity. Where are we as a society now, including Don, the whole election thing and as you mentioned, Adam, the polarization. Idea.
I mean, I think September 11th was definitely sort of one of these historical markers that triggered, if we want to use that word, triggered some of that anxiety. You know, the difficulty with terrorism is that you can't know it, you can't understand it. Terrorism is largely symbolic in this sort of way, and so when we think about the symbolic gesture that is terrorism, it is that thing that is unknowable, right? As opposed to sort of the old school notion of armies that you can clearly identify. And I think perhaps a reaction to that is, well, if we can't know that, if we can't control that, let's overly exert control on so many other things, right? I think another line in the Eliot poem where he says, you know, sort of compressing the universe into a ball, you know, that attempt to master everything, to keep that anxiety at bay. And what it's done, I think, for younger people, right, people who were born around that time or shortly thereafter, is that they have learned to be afraid or been taught to be afraid of everything, right, of that everything is potentially damaging, and that, you know, you add to that a sort of fascination that has emerged, and it certainly was here before September 11th, but a fascination with victim stories that we see in our culture. In thinking about this, even last night, I was flipping channels and it was on one of the cooking shows, you know, Chopped or whatever one of these things is. And each contestant, when they sort of are asked to tell their story, they all have this terrible sob story in some ways. And perhaps every contestant on Chopped does, I suppose. But, you know, that the culture has sort of shifted to, well, I'm an individual and I have my own victim story, right? And again, are there legitimate victim stories out there? Oh, yeah. Sadly, they're abundant. But so often, you know, well, I didn't get asked to prom by who I wanted to go to. Well, that's not a victim story. And yet, and so I think that there's this sort of, you know, double-edged sword of this where we become afraid of everything, but we also become fascinated with victimhood in some ways. And I think we see that really playing out.
Well, you mentioned the victimhood as a response to the, what are the other responses that we're that in fact we're seeing as an example, we have a desire for heroes. Now, so this is as unrealistic as the picture of the 1950s were. Mm-hmm. But I've been amazed at, again, when I was growing up in the 50s, comic books were for kids. Comic book characters were for kids. All of a sudden, you know, we have adult comic books. We have these fantastic heroes running around, you know, Broadway in hero costumes. What is going on with that kind of adult response to the kind of society we've got? This idea that we have these heroes, whether we think they're actually can be real, but nonetheless, it's our fantasy now as adults.
What seems to me that, well, some of that reaches back to, I mean, we had the great myth of the Old West. particularly 1950s and early 60s, in which there was some single gunslinger and he'd go out and he'd solve the whole problem. Of course, the real West, people got together with their guns and drove the bad guys out. Okay? It was a collective exercise, but we created this myth of the great individual who stands in the street and guns down the other guy. And it seems to me that in many ways, the heroes that we see in comic books and translate obviously into films, which are drawn from these things, I think they reflect that same kind of genre. I don't know whether I would put a lot of emphasis yet on the idea that these may be a reflection of the insecurity that we have as a nation. I mean, the difference about the war on terror and all that is that it now can reach into our daily lives. During the Cold War, everything was always outside of society. Yes, every once in a while we had to duck and cover and do all these things, but for the most part, the world did not reach into our world. I think it has now. It's very, very clear from whether it's 9/11 or obviously we have from time to time shootings and so on and so forth inside the country. At the same time, we're also now still extended outside of our boundaries into these various wars, which don't seem to have a conclusive end. So we're in a very different place with stateless enemies that will maybe disappear in Iraq, but will appear somewhere else. So, I mean, the world that the kids are growing up in now, right now, is so dramatically different than, say, the secure, if you believe it, the secure world of the Cold War. Mm. I mean, my brother once wrote a paper about the beginning of the Cold War, and he said it was prelude to uncertainty. I suspect it was really the opposite, that it was really the prelude to certainty. And once we got through the 1990s, which was sort of like the 1920s for all extents and purposes, we didn't really know what was going on, and it was fine. Everybody was having a good time. I mean, we had so much time we could impeach a president, right, over an affair, right? I mean, that's what we could do. 9/11 comes along and it dramatically shifts everything. And I think in terms of, like, simple ideas, so now we have a situation where the segment of the population rails against, for instance, illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants. That's a nice safe group, say, okay, we've got to keep them out because maybe they're taking their jobs or that sort of thing. Or we are attracted to a ban on Muslims coming in because there's this threat from abroad. So we do try to do these sort of simple, broad things in order to, say, fight those people outside. And I think in some ways, I mean, I don't know whether I haven't thought this one through, but maybe Donald Trump represents that comic hero, that hero that comes in and he's going to solve all the problems, right? He says that over and over and over again. Maybe he's the reflection of that hero that we're looking for, in this time of uncertainty.
Yuki, as a clinician, what Don just kind of alluded to, in looking for the hero that comes, it is a kind of sense of powerlessness. So you can have a hero who does have the power, who can change things, because you don't anymore. I mean, the difference between the civil rights movement was that we had the power. We were confident. We were willing to die. We were getting shot because we knew we were going to succeed, and we knew, in spite of everything, we had this under control to some degree. And we were, because of our numbers, we did have a sense of empowerment through those movements. Where are we today in terms of our powerlessness, or am I wrong here?
Yeah, I think, you know, if we were to really think about our current society as, you know, suffering from, as you mentioned earlier, cultural, you know, insecurity, or having some anxiety, like collective, right, like a societal, cultural anxiety, I think there is that sort of helplessness or hopelessness that tends to usually come. If someone as an individual is dealing with, let's say, anxiety, right, they may want to have some control over their life. So when we're talking about that sense of out of controlness, we usually sort of help that individual to have a little bit more sense of control, meaning they have intrinsic way in which they can figure out a way to sort of have a little bit more power and control over their lives so that not everything is chaotic, right? But I think when we were talking about things like war, right, we as individuals may not feel like we have a control over what is happening because we really don't, right? And so then there is that sense of feeling out of control, feeling anxious as a result of it. There isn't really much anything that we can do. And that leads to, you know, for example, Martin Seligman's learned helplessness, where you have learned to kind of say, well, I don't have a control over that. And what does that mean? And that could potentially then fuel that sense of fear, which could potentially then lead to wanting something magical, like superhero coming in to rescue. So, you know, like, I guess we'll find out in a decade or so as we reflect back if, you know, the whole movement of, you know, our sort of obsession to superheroes and whatnot, part of it is fueled by the fact that many of us enjoy watching those films, but to what extent that is related to this sort of societal, cultural sense, the overwhelming sense that we have about, you know, like of fear.
Because in the underlying, we've mentioned 9/11 as being from an international standpoint. I don't think we can underestimate the impact of the Great Recession on this current generation, in which not only, obviously, there's a lack of jobs, right, where they're going to graduate and trying to get on, but the security that certainly my parents felt of being able to work for 20 or 30 years at a company, that's all gone.
Right.
You got a changing economy, which, you know, the Uber economy, you got contracting going on, you have temporary work, you've got competition from overseas. So that's going to create its own anxiety and perhaps will fuel some xenophobia in terms of, oh, these people are taking away my jobs, whether it's in China or whether it's immigrants coming from here. And if you look at, I guess the simple thing is you look at the presidential campaign, you can see at least certainly Donald Trump playing on those fears. They're taking my jobs from overseas. They're taking my jobs here.
Yeah.
So that economic anxiety coupled with the uncertainty for terrorism and reaching in and so on creates for a much different experience than certainly I think any of us had when we were growing up.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. And I think it's interesting, the discussion about comic books. I think that there's sort of two comic book types that we're seeing right now. One is sort of born out of an anxiety that we need the hero to save us. And we even think about sort of the Batman movies. We're even willing to accept very questionable things in terms of someone providing order for us. I think history's shown us that doesn't work out really well. There are other comic book films, but the comic books themselves, that I think are sort of the opposite side of it. If we think, for example, about the X-Men comic books, where we have these individuals who, because of some genetic mutation, have some power. So this isn't Batman, who's just a rich guy who makes a bunch of nifty gadgets. Where, you know, in a comic book like that, either in the books or the films, that there is a sort of underlying discussion about multiculturalism, about even disability in some ways, the ideas of these sort of powers. And so I think there's sort of two different narratives that are very popular right now, and that do match up sort of very much politically with what we're seeing, right? The idea of an openness to things that might even frighten us, right, on the one side. And the flip side is, well, that maybe frightens me a little bit, so I just want it out, right? I either want to deport it or build a wall to keep it out. I think that the anxiety is real. I think it is in the culture that we live in, where everything is coming so quickly, it is very easily misdirected, right? And I don't just say redirected, because redirecting can be helpful, but misdirected. That, oh, well, are you anxious about economy or terrorism, right? Sort of these legitimate sort of concerns. And then it's targeted to, oh, well, you know who's to blame for that? This group, right? And then one particular group or a handful of groups become the targets. And again, we think, well, who's going to save us from whatever those groups are? Enter the strong man. And again, history has shown us that pattern very often. And it is atrocious, and yet there is a peculiar logic to how those things occur, right? I mean, again, I think it is a reaction of being fearful and frightened in that sort of sense.
In that light, What was the psychology that was to some degree behind the Bernie Sanders movement, and the fact that it was called a movement? I mean, Donald Trump also assembled thousands of people at one time, and we've kind of gotten that as the strong man idea that people maybe went to that for the strong man concept. With Bernie Sanders, these people kind of gave themselves to this idealistic, to some degree, movement of this little guy up there who all of a sudden, with the frizzy hair, had tremendous power. How do you factor that into this insecure society, if we can characterize it as that? What was Bernie Sanders all about?
I think one of the things with sort of his movement, as we say, I think is that the fact that his supporters were very young adults, right? And going back to sort of what we were alluding to earlier in terms of like each generation has sort of, you know, like what the older generations would say, oh, like this generation is this and that generation is that. We tend to think of young generations as not necessarily interested in elections, for example. Like, we can't get them to be interested in the current event. And there comes Bernie Sanders, who was able to mobilize these people. And I think the ways in which they actually were very active in supporting him was in use of social media, right? Which is a different ways of showcasing sort of their understanding. And I think they were very much passionate about sort of what Sanders was promoting they would do. And I think what resonated, I think, with the young people, or for example, you know, him talking about or understanding that college tuition, for example, is getting, you know, really expensive. And irrespective of which school you go to, it becomes very difficult. And I think, you know, now many adults can't afford, for example, to buy a house. That may not be possible because they're still paying the college debts, right? And so this current generation is seeing the parents that are actually suffering from that. And those are things that are different from, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. The whole notion of American dream in terms of what you're capable of doing if you work hard, it's starting to change. And so when someone like Sanders is talking about, you know, economic reform and trying to figure out a way to make college, you know, tuition free, it really kind of captivated young adults that are actually the generation in which they need that college degree in order to, you know, survive and thrive in our current society.
I think one thing, maybe Sanders stands in opposition to what Trump represents. Trump represents a guy who's going to come in and he's going to fix everything, right? Sanders, I think, seems to be the guy who says, no, we're all going to get together and we're going to have all these programs that are going to solve the problem, rather than I'm going to come in and deal with it. It was much more of a collective, for lack of a better word, effort, I think, that he represented. And certainly his pushback on some of the what I think has been sort of this conservative strain of small governments, got to get them out, you know, got to get it out from in front of you. These folks, and certainly Sanders himself, embraced a much more active role for the federal government and government in general to solve the problem that they're facing, which is whether it's high college debt or whether it's finding a job or whether it's making sure that they get health care, all those anxieties. He's offering to programmers, who I think Trump is offering himself.
The other thing that I would add to that is I think that Sanders was really successful in and this is perhaps not the right word, but sidestepping certain identity politics issues, right? That there were very rarely discussions about race per se. There were very rarely discussions about gender per se, right? That his the sort of language was always sort of about economic class. I mean, it's not surprising given who he is, which in some ways I think in the way that it was presented sort of transcends these other categories for Bernie himself, and I think for a lot of his supporters, that we've had, you know, a number of decades where sort of different identity politics have been very much big discussions in our culture, and that Sanders, in essence, part of the message was, it doesn't matter what you are, you're getting the shaft by rich people, and that's the big problem. And so I think that it had an interesting message for younger individuals who don't have the history of these discussions about identity politics, but also found some comfort into latching onto something that let them not have to talk about race or gender or sexuality or any of these things. That it gave them one concrete thing to talk about, which was economy.
Do you think, though, that his message really kind of, in excluding identity politics, that he was sort of sidestepping the issue of race? Because if you looked at his crowds, they were predominantly white folks, right? So he was speaking, even though he wasn't talking about identity politics, right. Obviously, there was a certain, he was addressing the problems of this particular group. I mean, there's, you know what I mean?
No, I think so. I mean, I mean, it's interesting because the groups that get tired of talking about race are the ones who don't really have as much at stake. Right? As a white male, discussions of race are one thing to me. If you are African-American, Hispanic-American, Asian-American, whatever it is, it's a much more real experience in some ways. And so I think that you're right, that it's not surprising that you had a lot of young white people who were like, oh, thank God, we're not talking about race or gender or sexuality anymore. It's economics. Now, I think very few of them understood his economic policies.
Let me look back at powerlessness for a moment. Here you've got all of these young people, and they're kind of sitting there watching Hillary Clinton get coronated as the president and as the key Democratic candidate for the presidency. And all of a sudden, this little guy who has a message that resonates with them on a variety of different fronts offers them power, offers them the capacity to come together and maybe actually accomplish something. So the Clinton and the Trump train. Trump, okay, but it's nothing that they want that he's got. So they're not going to resonate to that. Hillary is a train that is just running, and they can't affect that either. And yet Bernie Sanders is offering all this potential, all of this possibility. It's like the 1960s. All of a sudden you see movement here. And with the message being a very, very good message for them, a compatible message for them, they see the opportunity to actually maybe make a difference somewhere. Does that make any sense to you?
I think, you know, it's similar to sort of what we were talking about earlier in terms of when you are feeling anxious and you're feeling that sense of control, what would you do? And you want to have that sense of control, regain the control back. But if you feel like you're so powerless, then you want something that is, you know, almost like a miracle or magical happen, something that doesn't particularly make sense, something that is so radical that needs to happen in order to kind of offset, right? And so if we were to kind of think about, you know, how some people may have reacted to the second part of President Obama's, you know, his term, right? That a lot of people had a lot of hopes and, you know, changes that they were hoping, and it didn't quite go in the way that some people would have wanted. And then if they were to think of Hillary Clinton's, you know, potential presidential era to be kind of continuing on in that train, then that radicalization, whether people were going to support Trump or support Sanders, right? Those, like, you know, like, it's kind of understandable to think that some people are thinking like, well, we need that much of a change, like that kind of radicalization of things to be to shake up the movement, right? And that's not to say that they actually understand like what the outcome or like what would follow, the ramification of that. But then, you know, if we haven't seen the changes that we want to see, I think it's only natural for us to then think, okay, we need to do something more. We need to actually step away from conventions and go with a businessman who may not have any political history, or we may have to go with someone who has a very radical, more of a socialist way of thinking about, you know, how the society needs to change.
You know, one of the things too is that there's a movement that we've almost forgotten now, which is the Occupy Wall Street movement, mm-hmm. which identified, quote, the 1%, right? And which is in this presidential election is really sort of echoed from that. You know, whether it's Bernie Sanders talking about the 1%, you've got Donald Trump talking about how he doesn't like the elites, he used to be part of them, and Hillary Clinton clearly has tried to grab some of that, even as she's, you know, made these speeches to the banking industry, right? She's got her foot sort of in both places at once. And I'm wondering whether or not what we're seeing in part is, it reminds me a bit, because just reading this book about Herbert Hoover's tenure in the White House. And at the end of his term, he was basically considered to be one of the people who coddled the bankers, who tried to bail them out, which he did. I mean, to create liquidity in the markets, very similar actually to Obama. Right. That there's this pushback. There's whether these people up above, when that may very well be true, that they're getting all the benefits and we're not getting any. So there's this kind of like, I don't, lack of a better word, class warfare. But it's more than just simply the generic class war, you know, that Republicans tend to use. But that there really is this resentment, which is not necessarily unfounded, but nonetheless, I mean, they see themselves not being able to do as well as perhaps they should, and then they see Donald Trump or somebody else flying around, and she's, why can't I be that way?
Well, me, we've got about 2 minutes left. Let me ask if you can do it in a minute and a half. What is the positive response that we can have today to this kind of mix that you've described here?
I mean, in my sense, and this may be sort of the closet optimist in me, and those who know may know that there's not much of one, but I think that again, we're, as a nation and as a global, I mean, we're in a global economy now, we are a global society, that we are still working through certain growing pains of coming to a greater understanding of others and others in every imaginable way, right? It is no longer as simple as saying, oh, well, it's this group against that group. Well, in the global culture, we are having to confront radically different belief systems and races and ideologies and any number of these sort of things. And that I think, with a number of moments in the past, there is going to be a very uncomfortable, awkward phase of growth that moves us towards a more open and pluralistic society.
Well, let me ask one more quick question. A great body of literature grew up in the 1950s during the age of anxiety. What's being written today? Not 30 seconds. What's being written?
I would, in a general sort of sense, I would say that there is an increase in types of stuff that's being written, right? Which again, I think goes towards this sort of pluralistic notion. And that one of the things that we see is really a rise in experimental fiction, right? And I think that that in itself is a response to a world that seems chaotic, and yet it's a desire to learn to rethink or to think differently than we have in the past in order to move forward.
And to organize it in some imaginative
or perhaps way. To accept that there is no organizing. Adam, there is no way to put it together.
You get the last. You've got the. You had the last word, Adam. Adam, Yuki, and Don, thanks for joining us today on Delmarva Today Writers Edition, and for this really fantastic discussion. And for all of us who measure out our lives in coffee spoons, let me return to T.S. Eliot. I know the voice is dying with a dying fall beneath the music from a farther room. So how should I presume? How should we presume indeed? But then, how can we not presume? Thank you all for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.